Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey everyone, welcome to a perpetual feast here on the Circe Institute Podcast Network. I'm David Kern, a producer here at the Circe Podcast Network, and before we kick it over to the show with Wes Callahan and Andrew Kern, I just need to say a quick word from our sponsor. Roman Rhodes Media is a publisher of classical Christian curriculum designed for homeschoolers and homeschool co-ops, and they're back this year with a giveaway for Circe Podcast listeners. Each episode of Perpetual Feast, they're going to be giving away one of the 16 units from Wes Callahan's Old Western Culture series, a high school video course that guides you through the great books of Western Civ. Complete with workbooks, discussion, questions, and readers, Wes Callahan draws from decades of teaching experience as he tells the story of Western civilization, integrating history, literature, theology, politics, philosophy, and so much more. Here's how to enter this giveaway. When this episode is posted on our Facebook page, on the Circe Facebook page, leave a comment saying which unit of the Old Western Culture you would choose if you win. One of the comments will be drawn at random 3 days after the episode is posted. To browse the available titles in the Old Western Culture series, please visit www.romanroadsmedia.com. So thanks to our good friends over at Roman Rhodes Media for sponsoring this season of A Perpetual Feast, especially with Wes Callahan being one of the co-stars of this show. We are really honored to continue partnering with Roman Rhodes and with Wes Callahan to make great content for you. We hope you really enjoy this season. So without further ado, I'll kick it over to Andrew Kern and Wes Callahan and their ongoing conversation of the works of Homer. Enjoy.
While these fought on around the well-benched vessel, Patroclus came and stood by Achilles, the people's shepherd, shedding warm tears like a spring of black-sourced water that sends its dark stream coursing down some deserted rock face. At the sight of him, swift-footed noble Achilles felt pity and addressed himself to him, speaking with winged words. "Why are you weeping, Patroclus, like a girl? A small child who runs to her mother's side and begs to be picked up, clutching at her dress, delays her when she's busy, looks up at her tearfully till she gives in and carries her. That's what you're like, Patroclus, shedding those big round tears. Have you got some news for the Myrmidons or for me myself or a message from Phthia that you alone know about? Menoetius, Actor's son, still lives, they say, and Peleus, Iacchus's son, is alive there among the Myrmidons. For those two, indeed, we'd grieve sorely if they were dead. Or is your lament for the Argives, the way they're being slaughtered by the hollow ships on account of their own presumption? Speak up. Don't keep it a secret. We both should know it.
Andrew.
Oh, hello, Wes.
Hi, how are you?
What? Cocktaila.
You are reading the Iliad.
I am, but I just tricked you. I learned a Russian phrase and I wanted to use it. It means, what's up?
I'll do the response.
Yes, I am.
And you're reading about Patroclus. What are you finding?
Indeed, I am. What am I finding? Well, forgive me for imitating Hamlet. Words. Words.
Words.
Words. I'm finding that.
Yeah, we all know where that got it.
Right. I'm finding that at the end of book 15, there was crazy chaos. And then when we come to book 16, Homer just drops the chaos and everything's calm. And the whole feeling changes, but Achilles and Patroclus have their own little, what do you think? Is it a battle? But there's warm tears and pity and no longer killing, but pity. I find it intriguing that Achilles pitied Patroclus.
I like this. I like this passage very much. I was glad to come in on you reading it, because one of the things that strikes me when I read this is Patroclus suddenly shows up, and because the Iliad is so long, such a massive work, we have forgotten that where Patroclus was. He shows up, and we kind of come to our senses, and oh yeah, Patroclus, because in the story we haven't seen him since the end of, I think it's book 11, where he encounters Nestor, and Nestor gives him a suggestion about go back to Achilles and do this and that. And then Homer drops him, and in 12, 13, 14, 15, we have the battle around the wall, and we have Hera and Poseidon getting involved. And then in 15, we have the tremendous chaos you just mentioned. And then suddenly Patroclus shows up. But I made a little note to myself, with a little smiley face, sort of, with a beard on it, because I have a beard. And a note to myself that Patroclus has been, we last saw him with Nestor further up the beach, up the camp, 4 books ago. And so what has Patroclus been doing during all these 4 books? Has he been walking slowly toward Achilles' tent? But it helps to keep the big structure of the story in mind to remember when we last saw him and where he's come from, so that we're not surprised and think, oh, Patroclus, brilliant. What a radical shift.
That's brilliant. So tell me, what do you think Patroclus has been doing since book 11?
Well, one thing that occurs to me, it might be that books 12 through 15 were happening around the same time, that we have two chronologically parallel threads. That's a possibility. Another possibility is I think Homer suggests, they'd have to go back and look, but I think Homer suggests at the end of book 11 that Patroclus, after talking with Nestor, stops and spends time with some of the wounded heroes, because a bunch of heroes get wounded in book 11, including his friends, some of his friends, Menoetius and some of the others. So I think maybe what he's doing, Homer suggests that he's out of compassion stopping and visiting the Red Cross tent where his wounded buddies are, and that's where he is during the events of 12 through 15.
Fascinating, because one of the things that I'm trying to remember where I heard this phrase, but they call books 12 through 15, or this day, they call it the longest day. And isn't pretty well all of this from 12 through 15 in the morning?
It is. At the beginning of book 11, day dawns, and actually evening won't fall until book 18, when news comes to Achilles about Patroclus. So all of this is in the first half of a day. I think the middle of the day comes, is it in book 16? It might be. So yeah, a lot of stuff has happened just in the hours since dawn.
So 11 to 18 is all one day.
Yeah.
Amazing.
And that's another one of the advantages of course, the first time you read the Iliad, you just plunge through. It's like listening to a symphony the first time. You don't worry about the structure. You don't worry about the details. You just take it in, let it wash over you. And then you can go back and take your CD home and listen to it over and over again, listen to parts. And the same thing here. If we get the big structure in mind, then we have then we start noticing things like, books 2 through 7 were all one day. Books 11 through 18 were all one day. And we realize that as much as happens in these books, not a lot of time is passing. There's a lot of activity and not very much time.
Huh. Homer doesn't seem. Go ahead. Sorry.
Well, I was just going to say, I think something people point out that something like from the beginning of book 1 to the end of book 24, something like, you know, a few weeks pass, 5 or 6 weeks. But actually, most of that time passes in at the end of book 1, when we discover that Zeus is off feasting with the Ethiopians and Thetis can't go make a request yet. So really, the vast majority of the action in the Iliad takes place in just a few days.
Yeah. As I recall, the beginning of the Iliad has an event followed by either 10 or 12 days of no narrative, and the end of the Iliad is 12 days followed by an event. So yeah. I think it has a chronologically what they call a chiastic structure.
Yeah.
And I think that the, from day one of book one to whatever it is at the end of book 24, I think there's 55 total days.
Yeah.
But I believe we only actually see 4 or 5 days.
Yeah.
Some scholar out there, somebody who loves Homer, is going to be able to correct that exactly. But we see only a very few days in this 10-year war. And that's, to me, that's very significant.
Yeah.
I don't know why.
But we can take it by faith that it is.
Yeah. Yeah. And so 11 to 18 out of 24 books, that puts you from the middle book, which is 12 or so, to 3/4 of the way through being this focused, concentrated day where an awful lot happens to prepare for the very last portion of the book.
Yeah.
I'm glad you brought in symphonies.
Why is that?
Well, because you know, music is so formal. If you're not a formal person at all, you just don't like music, right? Because that's what music is. It's sound forms. Uh-huh. And we add lyrics to it, so either so you can remember it or so that you can put emotion or words to the feelings or whatever. But music is so formal and really complex music corresponds to something like Homer. And so what I'm thinking here is, now we did talk about in a previous session the structure of the Iliad, but what I'm thinking right now is, if we could identify the major movements of the Iliad, that might help us talk about it. Also might help people read it. Uh-huh. So I'm wondering what you think of that. As I recall, we had proposed that, I did anyway, I dogmatically insisted that there's basically three sections to the Iliad, uh-huh, and that they're paralleled. This is my hypothesis, that they're paralleled by the beginning, the, what do you call that again? The prolegomena?
Exordium.
No, the proemium. Prologue?
Exordium.
Yeah, all the above. Proemium, okay. Yeah, at where Homer says, and you've read this, I think, in these sessions, where Homer says, and it's important to say, Homer is addressing, well, the muse. Homer says, "Wrath, goddess, sing of Achilles, Peleus' son's calamitous wrath, which hit the Achaeans with countless ills." And then there's two more lines of that. And then he says, "And the plan of Zeus was fulfilled." Or in Lattimore, the will of Zeus was moving toward its end. And my hypothesis is that the structure of the book has already been reflected right there, that in each section, we're going to read about the wrath of Achilles at the beginning, and it's going to be ended by the will of Zeus being established. And now, okay, of course, throughout each section, you're seeing both the wrath of Achilles and its effects and the will of Zeus. But Homer sort of begins each section by highlighting the wrath of Achilles and ends each section by highlighting the will of Zeus. So my suggestion then is that we, in this podcast right now, that you and I test my hypothesis. I'll try to make my case and you can challenge it if you like. And then we'll look at the three sections, and that maybe will help people get an overview of the whole Iliad, as well as maybe it can help them sort of locate themselves in the Iliad. Because even if I'm wrong, it'll help people know where they stand in relation to the story. And let me add this, that 8 books is easier to keep your place in than 24.
That's true. No, I agree with you. I like that idea. We immediately run into a difficulty here, Andrew. Uh-oh. Yeah. The difficulty is that I agree with you, I'm sorry to say.
You jerk.
Attrition rising up in me already. As long as I have been teaching the Iliad, which is 25 years or so, I've been teaching it in 3 parts broken up that way. What I hadn't seen until a few years ago, and I haven't and hadn't seen it, put it quite as clearly as you, is what now, now that you've said it, seems fairly obvious that the beginning and end of each section reflects that of those opening lines, as you said, that we have the beginning of each of the sections with the beginning with the wrath of Achilles and ending with the will of Zeus. Although as much as I would like to make you happy and argue contentiously with you, which is what my last name means, contentious, I can't. It does. Callahan means contentious, yeah, disputatious. Maybe obnoxious. I don't know.
That's awesome.
It originated with some 10th century low-level lord in Southern Ireland who apparently was always a fly in the ointment of one of the Irish kings.
So, you know what my last name means?
What is that?
My last name is Kern, K-E-R-N, and it's a German word that basically means the center of the universe. That seems appropriate.
Well, now I feel the contentious part of me kicking in.
Okay, good. Yeah, that's what I was going for. There's also a tribe called the Kerns, or a group of tribes called the Kerns in Shakespeare, I think in Macbeth. They're an Irish tribe of savage, out of control people. So.
The Irish often think they're the center of the universe. That's why they get drunk so much, just to avoid that feeling. That's their Christian response.
Oh.
So I have seen for a long time, because I think it's fairly apparent in the structure, the three parts that the whole Iliad's divided into. But I find myself persuaded immediately by your assertion that the beginning and end of each part is the anger of Achilles at the beginning and the will of Zeus at the end. Because I can thinking about those three parts, I can see those. And I think that's a nice way of tying it in to the exordium. So much to our chagrin, I agree with you.
Well, maybe what we should do is try to be useful for the podcast listeners, and let's look at each section and show how this is the case. I mean, I hate that we can't have a fight here, but
every time we turn around, peace keeps breaking out. Darn it!
Yeah, what the heck? Call this a classical education?
Okay, that sounds like a good idea.
In fact. Yeah. How can this be? Because in line six of book one, this is the line: from the first moment, those two men parted in fury. This is a book about men parting in fury, not getting along. Come on.
Because in lines eight and nine, it says what God set them together in bitter collision. We don't have Apollo around to force us into contention. You know,
that's the thing.
I think that's it. And it's a good thing
too.
We have
a God of peace.
Yes, we do.
Huh. I like that. All right. Yeah. I'll be at peace with you then.
Okay, good. You're my brother. Well, yeah, thanks. I like your idea. Let's look at the three sections. I think that would be useful and instructive.
Well, okay.
Helpful.
So then let's take a brief look at the opening that I read. Brief, productive, and helpful. Is that what you said? Productive. Okay. Yes. So it's so ironic though, isn't it? Because will you be quiet?
I had to find some way of making you mad.
Yeah. Because the first word is wrath, right? Yeah. Wrath goddess.
Yeah.
Sing of Achilles, Peleus' sons, calamitous wrath, which hit the Achaeans with countless ills. And then it talks about them, you know, their judge, their souls going to Hades and all that.
Yeah.
So, And then from the first moment, those two men parted in fury. So now we've got the theme, or at least we've got the driving energy of the book, which is wrath in its mainest. It's Achilles' almost divine wrath. And so books 1, 9, and 16 all involve Achilles' wrath deepening or modifying. Yeah. Or in some way, Achilles is drawn into the action.
Yeah.
So give me book one. How does it happen in book one? Now we've talked about this in former podcasts, but so concisely, mm-hmm. what happens in book one that leads to Achilles having a fit?
Well, in book one, there's a problem that arises, that the story opens on sort of in medias res. the men had in some relatively insignificant, the Achaean men in a relatively insignificant raid down the beach, probably in a moment of boredom and looking for entertainment, raided some village, killed some men, captured some women. One of the girls was the daughter of the priest of Apollo, and he comes to the Achaean camp to try and ransom her back, and Agamemnon cruelly and angrily refuses him, repulses the old man, sends him away, and the old man goes away and prays to Apollo for vengeance, and Apollo comes down and starts slaughtering the men in the camp. They're falling from a plague, dying by a plague. So the men gather together and ask the prophet Calchas what's going on, and he says, "Well, I can't tell you because as soon as I name the guy whose fault it is, he's going to be angry." And Achilles says, "Don't worry, I'll protect you, even if you mean Agamemnon." And Calchas goes, "Yeah, that's the guy." And so in this assembly, it turns out that Agamemnon has offended Apollo by not returning the girl. The men then, led by Achilles, which is the problem, Achilles becomes kind of a lightning rod. The men led by Achilles ask Agamemnon to return the girl who had been a battle prize awarded to him. And they say, "Don't worry, if you have to give up the girl, we'll make it up to you several times over. You won't have lost out on your due meed of honor by giving the girl back." But Agamemnon, being the hothead he is, flies into a rage. This is unacceptable, even though he's been promised that they'll make it right. And so then he says, "All right, fine, but I'm going to take away your girl, Achilles." He turns to Achilles because Achilles is leading this discussion, the men. "I'm going to take your girl, Achilles, see how you like that." And he makes no offer of restoring, of making up for the girl. He's going to take her away. And this is a terrible dishonor for Achilles, as we've talked about before and probably will talk about again. And so he withdraws in a huff, angry at Agamemnon, and vows not to fight anymore. He's angry at Agamemnon for dishonoring him in a way that I think Achilles's anger is justified here at this point in the story. He's angry at Agamemnon for dishonoring him, refuses to fight. And that generates then everything that's going to happen in the rest of this section. In fact, in the whole of the poem, Agamemnon's dishonored Achilles irrationally too, by the way.
Yeah. Huh. Huh.
So Agamemnon is a hothead. He's one of those guys, and we all know people like this. He's one of those guys who gets angry really quickly, but then it gets over it quickly. And the next day he's like, "What? You're still mad about that? That was yesterday." Achilles is the other kind of person. I'm afraid I tend to be more like this, and I know lots of people this way. He doesn't get angry easily, but when he does, he gets cold and silent, doesn't talk, and he holds onto it for a long, long time. And the conflict between those two personalities makes for a lot of what's going to happen when we get to the end of this first section. Uh-huh.
So the energy of the book from one perspective is anger. It drives for the plot and everything. One of the things that I'd like over time to do as we discuss this, and not necessarily in this podcast, but to really explore what is it that Achilles is angry about? I mean, he's told us in story form, but what does it tell us about ourselves?
Yeah. I think there's more to the backstory behind why Achilles is angry and why I think it's justified that I think is helpful in doing what you're suggesting, trying to apply this to ourselves as well.
Huh. Well, let me put that on hold or bracket it for now. I definitely want to talk about it at some point, but I'm in my hypothesis, book one, it launches Achilles' anger, but book eight shows Zeus retaining control or establishing his will. So if you don't mind, I'm going to jump to book eight. And you want to read or you want me to read again? Because I got to read at the opening of our
where are we going to? I'll read
the very beginning. The very beginning of book eight.
"Now dawned the yellow robes scattered over all the earth. Zeus, who joys in the thunder, made an assembly of all the immortals upon the highest peak of rugged Olympus. There he spoke to them himself, and the other divinities listened. 'Hear me, all you gods and all you goddesses, hear me while I speak forth what the heart within my breast urges. Now let no female divinity nor male god either presume to cut across the way of my word, but consent to it, all of you, so that I can make an end in speed of these matters.' and anyone I perceive against the gods' will attempting to go among the Trojans and help them, or among the Danaans, he shall go whipped against his dignity back to Olympus, or I shall take him and dash him down to the murk of Tartaros, far below, where the uttermost depth of the pit lies under earth, where there are gates of iron and a brazen doorstone, as far beneath the house of Hades as from earth the sky lies. Then he will see how far I am strongest of all the immortals. Come, you gods, make this endeavor that all that you all may learn this. And by the way, we could go back, since the point here is Zeus concluding this section. I think it's there where he says in line 9, consent to what I'm going to tell you so that I can make an end and speed of these matters.
Yeah, yeah. Excellent. Read the picture he uses here to show how powerful he is.
Come, you gods, make this endeavor that you all may learn this. Let down out of the sky a cord of gold. Lay hold of it, all you who are gods and all who are goddesses. Yet not even so can you drag down Zeus from the sky to the ground. Not Zeus, the high lord of counsel, though you try until you grow weary. Yet whenever I might strongly be minded to pull you, I could drag you up earth and all and sea and all with you. Then fetch the golden rope about the horn of Olympus and make it fast so that once more, all once more should dangle in midair. So much stronger am I than the gods and stronger than mortals.
Which, of course, is words, but what's the response? What's the next line?
Yeah, so he spoke, and all of them stayed stricken to silence, stunned at his word, for indeed he had spoken to them very strongly.
Yeah, yeah. So I think what we see here in Book 8 is he's taking control again, and he's telling the gods. Now, we didn't get a chance to talk about Books 2 through 7 and all the stuff that happens during this section, but at least we've got a sense now that at the beginning, Achilles is enraged. All kinds of conflict happens, led apparently by Apollo. But even Apollo is being used by Zeus to accomplish his ends. I like the lines you brought up, Book 9, 8 and 9. Make an attempt to thwart my scheme is the way Peter Green translated it. Make an attempt to thwart my scheme, but all alike assent to it, so I may speedily bring these things to pass. And thus, and then Book 8 plays that out, you know. Now, in Section 2, that's Book 9, and some people don't think Book 10 belongs in the Iliad. I think they're mad, but we'll get to that later. But what happens in Book 9 where Achilles is then aroused to action in some way?
Yeah.
If not to action, at least to a decision.
Yeah, well, in Book 9, Agamemnon has come around makes an offer to Achilles to restore his honor, which is what Achilles said that he wanted, that he was going to withdraw from the fighting until the Achaeans had learned their lesson that they need him. And so Agamemnon sends a message via Odysseus and a couple of others to Achilles' camp, offering a magnificent gift. Prizes and women and land and wives and so on, which Achilles rejects. You're right. He makes the decision here, and the decision is to continue on in his inaction, to stay in the camp, not to come out to fight. He's not ready. He's now in a position where, even though Agamemnon has done ostensibly what Achilles asked for, Achilles will continue not to fight until further developments.
And if people, go ahead.
Yeah. I guess to try and wrap that up. Your hypothesis, which we're testing and which I agree with, is that the action of Book 9, Achilles' wrath in Book 9, drives what happens next. And it does by him continuing, I think, in my opinion, unjustifiably, which we can talk about later. Uh-huh. But his decision to continue to stay out of the fighting will result in further developments of the next section, which will become tragic.
Well, happily, we have a conflict now, because in Book 9, well, let me back up a step. The conflict is between you and me, I believe Achilles is justified in what he does. I also believe that Achilles does change his mind. And here's what I mean. In the beginning of Book 9, Achilles has decided he's leaving. Agamemnon sends three men to him, each of, and this is really great. This is where a side application, if you like, this is where Homer becomes a teacher to the Greeks. He sends three different men who present three different kinds of speech based on three different forms of proof. Odysseus gives a speech more or less based on logos. Phoenix gives a speech based on pathos or emotion, and Ajax gives a speech based on ethos or character. Ajax says, I have nothing to say to you. I'm a great soldier. That's all there is to it. And that's the one that interestingly seems to persuade Achilles the most. But, and practically, this is the plot point. As each person gives their speech, Achilles changes his mind a little bit so that by the time they're done, he has said, okay, I will stay. And I think, doesn't he also say at that point, no, he's not sending Patroclus into battle, but he has decided to stay and to view the fight. And I think given that context, that's a pretty good accomplishment by those three guys. They didn't get what they wanted, but they got what was most necessary.
Having him stay.
Yeah.
Well, that's true. But that's a different thing from saying that he's justified in continuing to not fight.
Well, that's a bigger argument that we can't get into now. I'll take you down on that one later.
I look forward to it.
Apollo is visiting me. So in other words, what's happening in book nine is that Achilles' wrath is renewed because we have not seen much of Achilles at all in 2-8. That's one thing we couldn't get into. But through that whole first section, Achilles has been withdrawn and silent in his tent when we get or house, really. When we get to book nine, they approach. He's playing his harp, singing songs about heroes. And then they talk to him and he's featured for a book. But from 9 through, and I'm suggesting 15 is the end of the second section, from 9 through 15, he's still not there. He's not in the battle. He's at his house, but he's not in the battle. So now let's go to book 15. Or did you want to read anything from book 9?
No, we can do that. We can do that later. Let's keep going.
We've got about 3 minutes left. So what I want to do is look at book 15, and then we'll end on this. And in the next session, we'll quickly talk about section 3, which is, man, I mean, I've heard it called the most perfect poetry ever written. So we're going to have to really exercise self-control and talk about book 3 briefly. And then we'll come back and talk about book 1 more closely.
Okay.
But in book 15, once again, Zeus arouses himself. Do you want to read book 15, the beginning?
Sure. But after they had crossed back over the ditch and the sharp stakes in flight, and many had gone down under the hands of the Danaans, they checked about once more and stood their ground by the chariots, green for fear and terrified. But now Zeus wakened by Hera of the gold throne on the high places of Ida and stood suddenly upright and saw the Achaeans and Trojans, these driven to flight, the others harrying them in confusion. these last Argives, and saw among them the Lord Poseidon. He saw Hector lying in the plain, his companions sitting around him, he dazed at the heart and breathing painfully, vomiting blood since not the weakest Achaean had hit him. Then the father of gods and men, seeing Hector, pitied him and looked scowling terribly at Hera and spoke a word to her. Hopeless one, it was your evil design, your treachery, Hera, that stayed brilliant Hector from battle, terrified his people. I do not know, perhaps for this contrivance of evil and pain, you will win first reward when I lash you with whip strokes. Do you not remember that time you hung from high, and on your feet I slung two anvils, and about your hands drove a golden chain, unbreakable? You among the clouds and the bright sky hung, nor could the gods about tall Olympus endure it, and stood about, but could not set you free. If I caught one, I would seize and throw him from the threshold until he landed stunned on the earth. Yet even so, the weariless agony for Heracles the godlike would not let go my spirit. You, with the north wind's aid, winning over the storm winds, drove him on across the desolate sea in evil intention, and then on these swept him away to Cos, the strong founded. I myself rescued him there and brought him back once more to horse-pasturing Argos when he had been through much hardship. I will remind you of all this, so you will give up your deceptions. See if your lovemaking in bed will help you. That way you lay with me apart from the gods and deceived me.
So he spoke, and the ox-eyed Lady Hera shivered. There again we see, now in this case, Hera has deceived Zeus to take control and thwarted short-term the will of Zeus, and now he's awakened, sees what's going on, and raises the theme of memory, which is such a big deal in Homer. Yeah. But Hera, don't you remember? I will remind you. but he's aroused to action again. So he's calling, he's re-entering the battle because he doesn't want the Trojans routed by the Greeks at this point. And so book 15 shows the result of Zeus re-entering the battle. Do you notice that in both 8 and 15, Zeus refers to hanging gods by golden chains?
Mm, yeah, interesting.
I've never noticed that before.
Now that's a theme, an obsession of Zeus.
Golden chains, yeah. Maybe that's just like a mark of power and vanity, people having golden chains.
It might be, but that phrase has resonance down through history too, doesn't it? I mean, as late as the early modern world in Shakespeare's time, cosmology was often depicted as a golden chain, the great chain of being. And Milton, that phrase was resonating in my mind now with Milton at the end of book two, when Satan flies out of Hades and hell and flies through chaos and breaks out into the clear space and sees heaven and earth, this new creation of God that he's determined to corrupt, and he sees the universe hanging below heaven in a golden chain. He says,
"Huh." Wow.
I'm not sure what to make of that. I just think it's really cool.
Yeah, that's good enough. Yeah, unfortunately, we're at about 36 or 37 minutes, and we're supposed to stop at 30, and we're probably losing listeners. So let's do this. Let's end, and then let's, as soon as we can, let's get back together again, and let's talk about section 3, which I'm proposing is 16 to 24, and then let's go back to books 1 to 8 and talk about that section a little more closely.
Okay.
How's that sound?
That sounds very good to me.
All right. See you shortly.
All right. Thanks, Andrew.
May the Lord remember you in his kingdom.
Thank you. God bless you.
And you.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.